so that I could talk a little bit about bright spots, and I think there really are. So it was interesting that my title got a question mark at the end of it, the way forward question mark. I actually think there's more than question marks here. There's real good news to go over. My one disclosure is that I serve as the chair of the Data Safety Monitoring Board for a drug called TMC-207 that I'll talk about a little bit. TibaTech pays my employer when I occasionally spend time reviewing the data from that study. I don't get any money. I want to step back in thinking about tools for TB to say, what do we need? What do you actually need to control tuberculosis? And so I broke that down into this fairly short list. And of course, one of the things we need is timely diagnosis. And that timely diagnosis prevents morbidity, mortality in the individual patient. But critically, in tuberculosis, timely diagnosis should allow us to initiate treatment and thereby cut off ongoing transmission. So absolutely a critical part of TB control. Secondly, we need infection control. That hasn't come up much, but there have been disastrous outbreaks of tuberculosis. I'll go through one of them that are in large part related to absence of infection control, particularly in healthcare settings. Carol certainly made the case that we need drug resistance testing. For a long time, we said, well, we don't need it because in high burden settings, there isn't much drug resistance, therefore we don't need it, but that day is clearly long past. And that allows us to use correct treatment. As she pointed out, the vast majority of persons in the world with multidrug-resistant tuberculosis don't know it, and they die of essentially untreated or undertreated tuberculosis. And then Randall very nicely showed to control tuberculosis, you need adherence to therapy. And in control programs, you have to be able to keep track of people for the time necessary to treat tuberculosis, which can be as short as 6 months, but can be much longer in that in the case of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. And then finally, you need contact tracing. As Ken mentioned, a key part of TB control, once you've found an infectious case, is to go look in the contacts both to detect other cases and to look for opportunities to prevent tuberculosis. So what do we use to fulfill those needs presently? Well, in the United States, we use sputum smear and culture primarily as the tools for diagnosis of tuberculosis. We have others. For infection control, we have really quite sophisticated systems once we recognize that a person may have tuberculosis. And the problems in the United States don't come from equipment. They come from lack of recognition that this person may have tuberculosis. For drug resistance testing, we currently use primarily culture-based systems which work and are quite good but are quite slow. For treatment regimens, you've heard what we use. And for contact tracing, the tools we use are a well-organized public health department, and they use chest x-ray and predominantly skin test, or have until recently. The situation is very different in high-burden settings in the world. Let's see if I can, there. As Carol mentioned, the diagnostic test in most parts of the world is an antiquated test with remarkable insensitivity. That's the sputum smear. There is essentially no infection control, or certainly until very recently in most places in the world. There is no drug resistance testing. Treatment regimens the common treatment regimen in many high burden settings is somewhat longer and substantially less effective than the one we use here. And then MDR treatment isn't even an issue. If you're not diagnosing it, then you obviously can't be treating it. There is increasing use of directly observed therapy, however, in the world over the last 20 years, and contact tracing in most settings is not done at all. Carol mentioned this, the problems of the sputum smear, particularly for two key subgroups of patients with tuberculosis, patients with HIV co-infection shown here, and shown in this slide, if you look at the left-hand set of bars, among persons who are HIV positive, about 45% of them had negative sputum smears despite having culture-proven pulmonary tuberculosis. So clearly a major limitation in using sputum smear. And it's even worse among children. There's the problem of children and tuberculosis has been all sorts of problems. One has been simply prioritization. For years, WHO has never even collected data on the burden of pediatric tuberculosis in the world. And the thinking has been, well, they're not a source of ongoing transmission of tuberculosis, and quite a few of them get better anyway. Therefore, we don't need to even count them, much less consider them significantly in our TB control programs. Sputum smear is probably positive in less than 5% of children. Again, drug susceptibility testing is not done. And when we try to treat the cases of pediatric tuberculosis that are recognized, we use inappropriate doses. It's been now shown in the last just few years that the WHO has been recommending half the dose that it should have for first-line drugs for children. And then because we don't have child-friendly formulations of TB drugs, we in TB clinics do all kinds of wacky things. We cut pills, we crush pills in non-standard ways. We give non-standard doses in non-standard ways, and we think that will all work out. It's interesting to think through the patient's perspective of what tuberculosis is like as well. And so here, in a nice study from Zambia, it gives you some of the flavor of the challenges of TB control, even in a country in which TB care is, quote, free. So there was an average of almost 7 health encounters before the diagnosis of tuberculosis was made, and that took an average of 2 months. The costs of free TB care were that almost half of patients had to be off work, and they were off work for an average of a month and a half. And just one interesting little statistic is that it was estimated that it took 16% of their income just to travel to and from clinic visits for tuberculosis care. So certainly demonstrating from the patient's perspective how challenging the diagnosis of tuberculosis can be. I want to just present a quick case example of what happens when we use these inadequate tools in the case of tuberculosis. And it comes from the recent experience in KwaZulu-Natal, the eastern province of South Africa, in a little town called Tugela Ferry, which has a very high TB incidence, as is typical for South Africa, with more than 1,000 cases per 100,000 per year. What that means for those of us who can't handle big figures is 1% of the population per year develops active tuberculosis. There's a very high rate of HIV in those settings. So, for example, in prenatal surveys, about 40% of women are infected with HIV. And this is a study done by Jerry Friedland and colleagues when they went to work in Tugela Ferry and noticed that patients were dying despite tuberculosis treatment and despite the availability of highly active antiretroviral therapy. And Jerry, as many of you may know, grew up professionally in New York City during the MDR outbreak there, and he took one look and said, I know what this is. This is MDR-TB that's not being diagnosed. And so he did a quick study of 544 patients with culture-proven tuberculosis. An astonishing 41% of them had multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. 10% of them had extensively, basically pan-resistant tuberculosis. So truly astonishing data that really rocked the world when they were first presented. For comparison, in this short time period, in this one small town in KwaZulu-Natal, there were twice as many cases of MDR-TB as in the United States that year. How did those patients do? Well, they did very much like Randall showed you patients did in the sanatorium with no drug treatment. And in fact, the death rates were shocking. So the line, the vertical line there, is the time to at least any kind of initial diagnostic test. And half of these patients died before they could get any kind of drug susceptibility testing. And initially people thought, well, there's some kind of outbreak at Tugela Ferry. And the answer, of course, wasn't that at all. That was the only place that this very broad-based outbreak had been detected. And it's now clear that multidrug-resistant tuberculosis is rising and rising relatively quickly in an area in which we long thought it didn't exist. So these maps only show just differences within a few years. And it's now estimated that more than 2% of TB cases in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa have multidrug resistance. How did that happen? Well, first, there was a very, very susceptible patient population, those with HIV co-infection. There was late diagnosis, really no infection control measures, lack of drug susceptibility testing, because we all thought you don't need it. There isn't any drug resistance there. There were overwhelmed TB treatment programs because of the burden of the astonishing increases in tuberculosis due to HIV. Therefore, they had a great difficulty assuring treatment completion, and there was no contact tracing. And so it was very predictable that MDR-TB was going to emerge in sub-Saharan Africa. What's shocking is how long it took to be recognized. So what tools then do we need if we're going to address those kind of problems and restore the momentum in global tuberculosis control? Well, I think we need diagnostic tests that work at the point of care And we'd like a test that's like rapid HIV testing that can be done really with almost no infrastructure that would work in these critical patient populations of those with HIV co-infection in children and also be highly specific. For drug susceptibility testing, we again need something that's simple and fast. The astonishing rates of death in HIV-infected patients say we can't wait 6 weeks, 8 weeks longer to get drug resistance tests back. We need a one-day test that can be done at district hospitals in high-burden settings like Africa. We need dramatically improved treatment regimens that allow us to regain control. So my goals are 1 to 2 month regimens for susceptible tuberculosis, a 6 month regimen for MDR-TB, and in that we need to assure that we do the right research to get validated pediatric child-friendly doses for all those situations. We need infection control in high-burden settings. It would be nice to have a better vaccine. And finally, for all that, we need political will to make it happen. Is that all pie in the sky? This is, when you do Google images and you ask for pie in the sky, this is what comes up. I want to say, actually, it's not. And so here's the good news part of the talk. So, for example, it seemed very pie in the sky to suggest that we could have a one-day test with excellent test characteristics that could work in a district hospital. Well, we may have at least the first step towards that. So this is an article just from a month or two ago in the New England Journal of Medicine using this system called GeneXpert. Importantly, it requires a single processing step. So up here, there's a single processing step. Then you put it in this container, put it in the machine, and 1 hour and 45 minutes later, you get these results. So in a large study done in four high-burden settings around the world with almost 2,000 patients, the sensitivity of a single test was 98% among smear-positive patients, 73% in smear-negative patients. If you did three separate specimens in GeneXpert, that increased the sensitivity to 90%, even in smear-negative cases. The specificity was 99%. Importantly, this test also includes the ability to test for rifampin resistance, the most important TB drug. And again, the performance characteristics were remarkable. So 98% sensitivity and specificity for the presence of rifampin resistance for a procedure that takes 1 hour and 45 minutes. And just shown here are a few other tests that are developing for latent tuberculosis. We now have blood tests that appear to have excellent test characteristics, not quite as good as GeneXpert, but good. And there are other tools that can be used for active tuberculosis, and I won't go through the data, but more sensitive microscopy systems, more rapid culture systems. And as I've shown you, nucleic acid amplification systems now have test characteristics that are approaching that of culture. So will we be able to use them when we have the right tests available? Well, there are certainly challenges. We can't just assume that once a great new test is available that it'll be used. In the United States, there are shrinking TB control programs budgets, so it's gone down, adjusted for inflation, by almost 40%. Will TB control programs be able to use a new good test? And then finally, I think we're all overly familiar with old and superficially inexpensive tests like the skin test. We say it's inexpensive because the material that you inject under the skin is cheap. It's not cheap to hire an outreach worker to do that and to go read the test. In high burden settings, there are a number of challenges to introducing a very good test like we've shown. There's the technical demands of mycobacterial culture. And even though GeneXpert is simple, there are still substantial challenges to be able to introduce that into, for example, district hospitals that don't even have adequate power supplies in high-burden settings. We're surely going to need algorithms to target the use of these kind of tests. We can't do them in everyone who presents, and we'll need funding. And then perhaps one of the most little recognized but most important barriers to the rollout of any of these new diagnostic tests is the lack of laboratory personnel. It's a remarkable shortage in high-burden settings. I work in TB drug development, and we call it the Rip-Van Winkle disease because nothing has happened. Thambutol was approved in the United States in 1968, and essentially nothing has happened in TB drug development since 1968. But there's actually a lot happening now. There's been a real renaissance of TB drug development, and I won't go through these drugs. The important part at the bottom of the slide is shown here are these various number and letter drugs, which don't have names yet, But there are four new classes, so these drugs should retain complete activity against multi-drug resistant strains, for example, assuming that they work for tuberculosis. Will they work? We have initial data that they will. So this is the very first data in a randomized clinical trial of one of these new drugs, TMC-207. And it was shown that in these patients, everybody got what was called optimized background therapy. That is, whatever their doctor thought was the best regimen for them to get. And they were randomized in addition to that to get placebo or the new drug. This is the curve of culture conversion over the first couple of months of treatment. And you can see this dramatic improvement in culture conversion with this single change of the addition of TMC-207. So my thought is that within the next decade, we will see dramatic improvements in TB treatment. For MDR-TB, I think it's very likely that we'll have treatment regimens that are effective in less than a year and are dramatically better tolerated than the ones we have now. For drug-susceptible tuberculosis, I think we have regimens on the horizon that cut treatment in half to 3 months, and we may be able to go shorter than that. And for latent tuberculosis, I think within 5 years, we'll be at regimens that can work in a month or so. There will be certainly challenges in getting the research done that's needed to produce those improvements. We need expansions of in clinical trials capacity, particularly that for children. It's gratifying that the NIH has recently announced that they're going to use the clinical trials capacity of its networks to focus on TB, and I can say that's happening in a big way. This is not lip service. In the U.S., certainly the TB control program funding cuts are a challenge, but my guess is if we get good new drugs, they'll be used. In high burden settings, we're clearly going to have to think through the mechanism of funding improved drugs. Can we do it through the global fund? And then finally, we'll need to assure that these drugs are used appropriately to prevent MDR 2.0, that is MDR that's resistant to TMC-207 and some other drug. And we probably should take a cue from the malaria field and work towards co-formulation. That is, not have new drugs available except in a co-formulated form, so they can't be given as single drugs. I'll just say a word about TB vaccine development. I know there's interest here. There's a great deal of research happening in TB vaccines. I am not an expert in it at all. I can say that there are multiple new products that are going on into clinical trials right now, into phase two and even phase three clinical trials. So there's hope that we'll have improvements in vaccines as well. So that's a lot of good news. Will it actually happen, I think, is the big question now. One of the problems is just the lack of appropriate incentives for diagnostic, therapeutic, and vaccine developers in the TB field and other neglected diseases or diseases of poverty. And really, it's the problem of using patent exclusivity as the reward for innovation. When you can't sell your drug for a significant price, then patent exclusivity means nothing. It's not a reward for an innovative company. So there are other efforts underway. One is FDA already has a program in which a company that develops a new TB drug can get a voucher that assures them accelerated approval of any drug they want in their whole portfolio. I don't work in the industry, but it's estimated that that voucher may be worth as much as $50 million, so real money. There are now a lot of consideration of developing monetary prizes. So, for example, there's a proposed $100 million prize in TB diagnostics so that a company that could demonstrate they had achieved a major advance would just claim the prize rather than patent exclusivity. And then an important point is we sometimes forget the markets in emerging economies. So, for example, Brazil, Thailand, Indonesia, etc., there are real markets, and those may be markets in which money can be made in new diagnostics and new drugs, and we shouldn't ignore that. However, despite that, there's clearly going to need to be continued involvement by governmental funders, foundations, in assuring this kind of development. So I think we're in a time of great needs and great opportunities. There are major advancements in TB diagnostics, TB treatment, and TB vaccines on the horizon right now. I think we're going to be faced with a lot of these questions that we thought were completely pie in the sky as early as next year, like how do we control access to a new drug? There are, however, major challenges in being able to implement these improvements once they're available. But I'm actually fairly optimistic. With recognition and political will, I think the antiretroviral field shows what can be accomplished with much improved tools. So I'll stop there and happily take questions. questions, discussion? Yes, over here. The question is about outbreaks and about screening of healthcare workers. I think in the United States, those programs are well in place, and so there are specific recommendations for testing healthcare workers at specific intervals to identify acquisition of tuberculosis. There was an interesting study by Dick Menzies and his colleague and colleagues in Canada, and what they showed was that the greatest risk to healthcare workers was to work in a hospital where they seldom saw tuberculosis. And that seems paradoxical. Why would the risk of TB acquisition be highest in low-burden hospitals? And the reason was because they didn't recognize it. So I think the major challenge in infection control in the United States and other high market countries is lack of recognition. That's where transmission occurs in a healthcare setting, is when the diagnosis of tuberculosis is not even entertained. Once it's entertained, I think we abrogate transmission both to healthcare workers and other patients quite well in the United States. It's just lack of recognition. Other questions over here? Go ahead. Yeah, the question is how can Global Fund resources be used most efficiently to assure the rollout of these new tools when they become available? I'm not qualified to answer that. I would certainly hope that planning is going on, because again, I think in the TB world, like TB, TB grows very slowly. You know, compared to other bacteria, it takes a whole day for TB to divide. It takes E. coli 20 minutes. And so I think we've sort of picked up on that slowness in the TB world. We don't do things very fast. And we're used to thinking that everything's pie in the sky, that we could wish for improvements like occurred in other fields, but they really would never get to us. Well, the answer is they're gonna be. We're gonna see how do you roll out GeneXpert to high burden settings? How do you roll out TMC207 to high burden settings? And we have to learn fast, I think, from other fields about how that can be done. But I'm not the expert on how the specifics of how that should be done. Yeah.
So it seems that identifying latent TB infection seems like a key strategy in eliminating TB. So aside from contact investigations, what are some strategies to identify latent TB infections?
Yeah, the question is about latent tuberculosis. It is a key part of the strategy of TB elimination here in the United States and other places. And there's growing attention on the role that detection and treatment of latent tuberculosis in high burden settings might play. So I think for a lot of reasons, it's an important strategy. So what could we do to improve latent TB detection and treatment? Well, first, a better test. So the tuberculin skin test has been used for 125 years, and it certainly has its predictive abilities, but it has all kinds of problems. Getting people to come back in 2 or 3 days is a real challenge. Having them read their own skin test is a common strategy. That's been evaluated and it doesn't work. So I think we need tests which don't require those characteristics. The blood tests that are available are certainly not perfect, but they are a substantial improvement. So they involve a single blood sample, and by the next day you can have the readout of, is latent tuberculosis likely to be present? So I think those are an initial step in improving the diagnosis and making it much easier for programs to try to detect latent tuberculosis. And then we clearly need something other than our current treatment. So the current recommended treatment for latent tuberculosis is 9 months of daily isoniazid. And the treatment completion rates are probably in the 40% range. Even in so-called high-risk context, that is close context to an active case, children, completion rates are still very disappointing, 70%, 75%, even in high-risk context. And so we clearly need treatment that much better facilitates completion of treatment for latent tuberculosis. I think we're there. I think we're gonna have short, much more convenient latent tuberculosis treatments available within the next couple months, and there are better ones coming along. So I think we have tools in development that will really help in both the detection and the treatment of latent tuberculosis. Yes? The question is, what's the rate? Yeah, that's a great question. So really, what's the risk of latent tuberculosis? It varies by population characteristics, by patient characteristics. The old saw was used that it was 10% over the lifetime. Some recent reviews by Bob Horsberg and others have suggested that's probably too high a figure, that in HIV uninfected persons, the lifetime risk is probably more like 5% or less. But there are key characteristics that can make that dramatically higher. So, for example, untreated HIV, the annual risk of development of tuberculosis can be 5%. That is, the annual risk can approximate the lifetime risk in someone who doesn't have tuberculosis. And in other key subpopulations, there can be much higher risks of progression to active TB. So any kind of cell-mediated deficiency, and some things you don't think about as being immunodeficiencies are. So end-stage renal disease is an immunosuppressive condition and a fairly common underlying condition in persons with active tuberculosis. So I think to go back to your question, probably 5% overall. Much of that risk is right away in the first few months after acquisition of infection, but then in key subgroups, the risks are dramatically higher and there are more opportunities for intervention. Other questions? Well, please approach the speakers if there are other questions that you have that didn't get answered. Thank you for your attention, and the symposium's closed. Thank you.